This whole world is full of singers, but just a few were chosen to tear your heart out when they sing. Imagine life without all your radio heroes, like the outlaw that walks through Jesse's dream.
Hey everyone, this is Across the Table. My name is Matt Mendoza, and this is episode 22. It's a bit of an unconventional interview, not an interview, intro rather, because it's currently 6 in the morning, and my girlfriend and I, Lauren, you want to say hi?
Hi everyone!
Are about to head to Colorado, and then I will come back in a couple days to move and everything. So anyway, this is my interview with Steve Port. We met up at Gen Con and it was great. Steve is one of the nicest people I've ever met. So yeah, I'm really excited to share this interview with you. Lauren?
As always, Matt is interested in your feedback. Hit Matt up on Twitter at Matt Mendoza or via email at acrossthetablepod@gmail.com. Also, be sure to follow the cast on Twitter at AcrossTheCast or on Facebook for the latest news and episodes. Last but not least, leave the cast a review on iTunes. Reviews help get the podcast to audiences who don't normally troll CaseyCompetition.com or MandaDeprived.com, and tell your friends about the show.
Once again, thanks for listening. Look forward to next week and my interview with Level 1 Judge and World Traveler Michael Aerosmith on with the show.
All right.
What did I have for lunch today?
Or breakfast.
I had a Lunchable for breakfast.
A Lunchable? That is
what I've had to eat today.
Fulfilling.
What time is it? Is it lunchtime?
Thereabouts.
I realized just now, I actually have no clue what time it is.
That's Gen Con for you.
Welcome to Gen Con. One of the jobs I had for about 7 years was installing jukebox systems. I have a lot of audio experience.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah, I'm learning the process and everything. Yeah, yep. So I'm with Steve Port.
That's me.
He is the owner of Legion Supplies?
Yes, owner of Legion Supplies, Legion Events, and Legion Games in Burnsville, Minnesota.
Okay.
Sense of theme?
Yeah. So is it going to be like Legion Cafeteria next?
Probably.
Legion brand?
Probably. We'll do Legion
underwear.
Sportswear maybe.
And how long have you been doing this?
So I've been in the industry in one form or another. I ran my first Magic PTQ in April of 1997.
Okay.
I had been running events before that, but that was my first incursion into Premier Play. And then in 2001, I opened a store. In 2009, I started Legion Supplies.
Okay. And let's go way back. When did you start playing Magic?
I bought my first pack in December of 1993.
So, Alpha?
It was Beta.
It was Beta. Yep. Okay.
Unlimited.
Unlimited.
Beta had just gone through. I didn't have Beta. Like, I came in on the backside of Beta. We had Unlimited. Unlimited was scarce. It was still, like, people were scrambling for it, trying to figure out who had it. Somebody get a box in, and the phone calls would go out to all your friends as, like, Pegasus Games has got a box. Go get it. And everybody would, like, swarm and go get a pack. They'd limit us to, like, a pack or two packs at a time because they'd only get, two boxes of something in, and...
Wow. Yeah. Okay. And so you're from Minnesota?
I'm originally from Illinois. I lived in Madison, Wisconsin for 20 years. I just moved to Minnesota 2 years ago.
And why? So growing up in Wisconsin?
In Illinois.
Yep. Illinois. From Chicago or from?
Northwest Illinois. I grew up on a dairy farm.
Really?
I grew up on a dairy farm in the middle of nowhere on the west side of Illinois, about 20 minutes from the border to Iowa, just 20 minutes from the Mississippi there. And
full-fledged
dairy. My dad is a dairy farmer. Yep.
What was that like?
That was a lot of work.
Well, okay.
Wake up at 6 o'clock in the morning, go do your chores, get breakfast, get on a bus, ride the bus for an hour, go to school, come back home, do chores for a couple hours, do homework, go to bed.
Yeah. Oh, wow. So it sounds really regimented.
It's the farm life.
Gotcha. Yeah. How did you develop like this? When you discovered magic, were you a nerd already?
Yeah, I bought my first D&D book in 81, maybe.
And how old were you then?
I would have been 13, 14, depending on when I got it. I think 13.
Okay. How does a dairy farmer from northern
I was an isolated kid. It's a pretty familiar story to a lot of dorks. I was an isolated kid, you know, never really felt like I belonged. And somewhere in middle school, so 7th, 8th grade, I started reading fantasy books. I read The Hobbit.
Okay.
And, you know, and that thing just you know, like, it's like these people are speaking to me. It grabbed at something inside of me like so many other people do. And just made me want to read more fantasy. And I stopped reading anything. And I was a voracious reader as a child. I read through high school, I probably read 6 to 7 novels a week.
Wow.
Just series after series after series. There wasn't enough material for me at various points. I had to go digging for it. I read a lot of really terrible books because I had a small town.
You read all the good ones.
I read all the good ones, and then I read all the whatever was there. It's like, well, it's got a sword on the cover. I guess I'm reading it. You know, and there was a lot of terrible fiction back in the day, and so a lot of that read tons. But in 81, a friend of mine had an old D&D book, and I'd heard about it, but I didn't know anything about it. And he was like, yeah, my parents gave it to me for Christmas. It's not really my thing. Uh-huh. And so I'm like, I would like to buy that. So I scraped together, I think, $3 and bought it from him for $3.
That's a lot of scraping.
Yeah, it's a lot of scraping to a really poor farm kid in the middle of nowhere, Illinois. And got it, brought it home, and my mom was a little concerned. And because, you know, this was back in the day of the... What was that? There was the Tom Hanks movie that was that they did this thing. These college kids had gotten lost in these steam tunnels under a college, and Mazes and Monsters or something.
That's
like that.
That's what it was. Yeah, that's what it was. It was the really bad, like,
it wasn't a real good movie. It was all the rage. People were concerned about this Dungeons and Dragons thing and how it was corrupting the children. And so my mom was a little concerned for my safety, and so she didn't stop me. She didn't say you can't, but she said, let's just be careful with how we use this. And so I started playing, and because I was an isolated only kid, I did an awful lot of playing D&D all by myself up in my room.
Wow,
I figured out how to draw dungeons as I went. I made a system where it would manipulate it and put monsters in, and that's how I played D&D a lot growing up, until I found a couple of other kids, and then we'd, you know, once a month we'd manage to talk all our parents into letting us stay over, and we'd play D&D all night, and that's how I started back in the early 80s. So flash forward to 1993, I was in the middle of running a Blood Bowl league. Blood Bowl is a...
What is that?
It's a game put out by Games Workshop, or sporadically put out by Games Workshop.
Okay, they same company as Warhammer and 40K.
Correct. And this game is a football game on a board. And you're playing with teams of elves and dwarves. So it's really fantasy football.
Okay.
So you're, but it's like a football based game, and you have a team, and you can do it as a league format where there's a, you know, you're managing players, and players get injured, and it's a rough game. Sometimes they die, and you have to replace them. And so we did a league every year, and the particular year that Magic was happening, I had organized a league of something like 22 or 24 teams. It was so big we couldn't just do it in my house anymore. We had like 3 or 4 different houses we had to show up in to do it.
Whoa.
And then Magic came up, and a buddy of mine owned a comic store, and I said, hey, when you come over to league tonight, bring me some of those Magic packs I heard about. And so he brought me a couple of Magic packs, and I opened them, and it's all downhill after that.
And what would you do in the interim between, you know, 81 and 93, like...
I played a lot of D&D.
A lot of D&D?
Yeah, a lot of D&D. And then, you know, as the gateway drug, as it is so often in people, Dungeons & Dragons is really the first things that a lot of people hear or touch in this sort of fantasy world. Uh-huh. It was. Maybe it's not quite as much anymore, because there's so much fantastic content out there now.
Yeah.
So many fantastic games. It you're much more likely to be brought into this world through Settlers or Carcassonne or Ascension or any of the Rio games. There's just tons of amazing board games, and I think that's actually kind of really turning into the gateway into the world. and kind of going from there. D&D is truly really strong. It's the brand awareness on Dungeons & Dragons is incredible. Like, so many people, even if they don't play it and they're not interested in playing, they know it and they've heard it. They know what it is. Like, you say the word Dungeons & Dragons to somebody and they have an immediate reaction in some form. So they know what it is, and that's pretty important.
When you were in school and it was 81, 82, 83, you know, you were this farm kid who discovered D&D. Did you talk to anybody about it at school? I mean, were you...
A couple of kids, you know, it... So, really funny thing. So, I'm a student librarian. I'm sure that comes as a shock after some of the things I've said. I was a student librarian at school. Hello, I'm Steve Port. I'm a geek. Thank you very much. And so, I had exposure to all the sorts of kids. I would watch what they checked out.
Okay.
That kid checked out a fantasy book. Hey, have you heard of D&D? And he's like, yeah, I play it. So, that's how we, you know...
Clever.
Kind of build it together. Clever. We'd start playing a little bit at study halls. It was actually... Our librarian was fantastic. She was just fantastic and nurturing and just, like, all of the things that you want in someone in a position where they can affect children. And she allowed us to do... So, we drew up little adventures, like little modules. And we put them together. They're little dungeon crawls, and we'd write out the different rooms and things, and we'd Xerox them and made a handful of copies, and kids could check them out from the library. So they'd come in and check them out from the library and go play at study hall. We eventually built that up. So I guess, and it didn't occur to me until many, many, many years after I started running organized play for Wizards, and like launching into the different things that I've done. I was sitting talking with my mom about it. So this is maybe 5 or 6 years ago.
Uh-huh.
And saying, man, I sometimes don't know how I got here. Like, things have been so good for me. They've, you know, I feel so blessed and so lucky to have gotten where I've gotten. I know I work hard. Everybody says Steve works hard. He works harder than anybody I know. He's a really hard worker. But that's not it. It's a lot of it's luck, too.
Uh-huh.
Happened to be in the right place at the right time and see an opportunity. And I was talking with my mom about this and saying how blessed and fortunate I feel. And she said, you remember being a kid, right? Like, in sixth grade, I drew up a little book of all the things I could make. Because I was always a crafty kid, too. I was always making, creating. I know how to sew. I've made entire Ren Faire costumes. Like, there are all these things that I can do. And so back when I was a kid, I knew how to make things. I would make little pillows and quilts and stuffed animals. I once sold invisible fish. It was a baggie with colored water in it. And if you hand it to a kid and say... These fish, they're not actually really invisible. They're just really close to the color of the water. But if you hang on to it, you can feel them bumping around inside the bag. So you give it to them, and as they're moving around, their fingers make the water move a little bit, and it touches, and they go, oh, I felt it right there. I'd sell that kid a bag of water for 50 cents. So
so you're also a
you know, so since sixth grade, I've been doing things like this.
Uh-huh.
I'd forgotten about that. I'd forgotten about all those things, you know, and the organizing things at the library for D&D, like that's something I started as a 14-year-old. So I've always been kind of that guy that wants to do something, and to me, it's always been for other people a little bit. Like, it sounds a little corny saying I want to do something for other people and I sell them a bag of fish that don't exist, but the look on the face of that person when you tell them this thing and they're like, ah, yeah, that's crap, and then you hand it to them and then they would touch it, I would be like, that was really cool. You know, I would almost do it for free, but, you know, I get 50 cents out of it. Now I can go get a Coke.
I'm totally going to do that,
yeah,
by
it's,
the way.
It's really interesting, like the psychology of it. You have to set it up right and stuff, but the psychology of it's pretty amazing.
And what did your parents think of you growing up this budding nerd who was playing D&D a lot and then doing a lot of stuff? Like, you seemed like you weren't really into the farm.
Nope. I certainly was. And I loved growing up on a farm. I loved everything I got out of it. You know, we had horses I would use to go bring the cattle in when it was time to milk. Dad'd say, all right, get them. And I'd go get on the horse and I'd go out and I'd bring the cows in from pasture to go milk. So I grew up riding horses. And as a little older, as the horse got older, we got a motorcycle to replace her. So I grew up riding dirt bikes also.
Uh-huh.
And all of these things that I got to experience and I got to do. And my parents were very, you know, not worrisome. They were like, all right, it's Saturday. You've got your chores done. You know, be back here by supper time. And then, you know, I lived on a farm in the middle of nowhere, and there were fields and trees, and I would just get on the horse and I'd go ride for a while, and I'd come back. And they were always very enabling of anything I wanted to do. There was never a point in time where they said to me, you can't do that. That's not the way we do things. Don't do that. Because it was like, all right, you know, if that's what you want to do, do it.
Yeah.
And you know, you take the benefits of what comes to you. You take the repercussions of what comes to you. You know, either side of that thing that falls on. I did some dumb kids as a, things as a kid. Many of us have. Occasionally, I got a stern lecture or straight up punishment that I absolutely deserved. It's like, yep, that I had that coming.
So they weren't worried that you were playing too much D&D or too much.
My mom
whatever.
Said something when I brought that first home book. Like I'd said before, she said something to me when I first brought that book home of, hey, it seems like maybe there's some things going on with that. Make sure you don't get too deep.
Okay.
My mom is, my entire mom's family are some of the smartest people I've known. And in a room like this, we're sitting here at Gen Con filled with gamers who are, no joke about it, very smart people.
Yeah.
My mom's family is among the smartest people I've met. I have an uncle who I'd be shocked if his IQ was anything less than 170. He's just insanely brilliant, and they get it. And they're also, like I said, it was a great experience growing up. I walked out to the barn and my dad's playing Conway Twitty all kinds of, you know, George Jones, all old school country out in the barn. And I come inside and my mom's listening to Boston and Fleetwood Mac.
wow.
So that's the kind of broad experience that I grew up on, from the Stones to Hank Williams, I had exposure to a lot of things and taught as a young age, you know, don't discount anything. Every experience is valuable.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. Sounds like you had a really, really great childhood.
I other than the fact that I was a bit of a loner as far as school goes, I never really felt like I fit in at school. I didn't really like school. I'm not a good student. And that's something else I think that speaks to a lot of our generation. I didn't do well in school. I did okay. But I didn't feel like I belonged there. It was something I had to endure really more than anything. So
do you know what it was about school that made you feel
I don't like studying.
You don't like studying?
Okay. I don't like sitting in a class and have somebody talk to me. I learn very, very well tactilely. Like if you tell me there's a problem to solve and you send me at it, I'll figure out how to solve it.
I'm very similar.
Yeah, but I don't generally like having somebody just stand there and talk at me for 50 minutes. It doesn't make me learn. And it took a long time to figure that out too, like well into my 20s before I realized that like it wasn't just me. Like I wasn't some disaffected youth who is just like rebelling and saying, no, you teachers suck. I didn't learn well in school. I barely got through college. I just went to a 2-year program. I barely got through it.
What did you study?
My official degree is an associate's in electronics. So after I graduated school, before I started doing all this, I worked for a video game company who puts in jukeboxes and video games and pinballs. I worked on that for 7 years as a repair guy on those machines and doing installations of systems.
So you have kind of an affinity for old video game too.
I'm a tech guy, right? Yep. I played an awful lot of Street Fighter.
I remember when I'm interviewing all of the people who are like, yeah, I played Street Fighter, no big deal.
Yeah. I remember getting Mortal Kombat in. I was working for this when Mortal Kombat first came out, like the very first Mortal Kombat. We got it in our warehouse, and it sat there, and the guys in the office are like, yeah, go play that thing, figure it out. So, you know, break times, lunchtime, we'd go like, play Mortal Kombat and on a big upright stand-up thing. Yeah, it was neat.
Gotcha.
I loved the job. It paid for crap. Like, the hours were miserable and the pay was terrible, but it was a really cool job. And I did it for 7 years because I really, really liked it. But eventually moved on to, I worked on robotic medical sampling devices for drug discovery. So, like, the machines that move chemicals around and sample them and then inject them into a system and try to figure out what it is that's in that liquid. I worked on those for 2.5-3 years, and then
what did that give you?
That was really interesting. A much more refined job than the previous one was, in that I was dealing with a very specific machine at a very intense level. Where at the previous job with the amusement machine company, I had to be very good at a whole lot of things.
I had to have good installing things.
Yep, I had to have carpentry skills, and I had to have electronics knowledge. And I had to have very, very good troubleshooting skills. From straight old school, like pinballs, at least back in the day, pinballs were very, very old school electric. Like there are coils and switches as opposed to a lot of electronics involved in those. So real stripped down electronic work. A lot of mechanical, like a cigarette machine is 90% mechanical. So like something jams and I have to figure out how to get that motor out.
Yeah.
Where the auto sampler stuff is all electronic controlled. They're all stepper motors. The parts of the machine very rarely fail. It's usually a failure of operation, like the program isn't doing what it's supposed to be doing, right?
Okay.
And like how to fix that. So
you have to do software as well.
I also had to learn software. I've been on the internet since before the internet was an internet. I bought my first computer way back in the day, and my first modem was a 1400 baud, right where I would dial up into a bulletin board that I heard somebody had in Madison, and so I would dial up and download a couple things, check a message, leave a message on a board, you know, you get off and then you sit there and wait and wait and wait, and you jump back on, did anybody respond yet, so this was back in the 80s.
You mean you didn't have notifications that go directly to your cell phone?
Push notifications did not exist on anything. I did actually, I got to use a cell phone at the job with the video game company. We had a cell phone for the on-call guy, so the guy who was out all night, because we had to have somebody open while bars were open, so somebody worked till midnight every night. So we had, it was bigger than most, it was a bag phone. It was technically a cell phone.
Like a car phone.
It was the old car phone. It was probably about 10 to 12 inches long and about 6 inches wide and maybe about 7 or 8 inches tall. And it was a big bag, and it was 90% battery. And then you'd zip open the top and pull the phone out, and the phone was the phone was it by itself was probably a good 8 inches long or so, and probably about 3-4 inches wide, a couple inches deep. Like it was, and it had a cord, and it was down to the battery. It was a brick. The thing weighed about 30 pounds.
Yeah, my grandparents had one. I remember seeing it. I mean, remember it vividly, like taking up their whole console.
right. They're like, wow, this cool new device. Look how portable it is. And
yeah.
And in my hand, the audience can't see this, but in my hand, I am holding access to all of human knowledge, and it weighs under a pound.
Yep.
That's a cell phone right there. You know, I got a smartphone. I got a droid sitting over there that Star Trek didn't even dream about the sort of access we have that all of us carry around on a daily basis without even thinking about it.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
So you got into this electronics industry. You went to college.
Yep.
When did you meet your wife?
Well, that's a loaded question.
Okay.
I am on my third.
Okay.
I got married very young. My first wife was very similar background to me. Grew up on a dairy farm. We met when I moved to Wisconsin when I was 20. We met there. We were together for a couple of years. Got married, I think, by the time I was 23 or so.
Okay.
And then and we were together for about until I was 29, and then that broke up. It was a little bit of a surprise to me. We'd been having trouble, but I didn't realize we were in that spot. So all of a sudden, I was like, "Crap, I'm divorced." And so I had a tilt marriage, I call.
Marriage.
A tilt marriage. I was on tilt. My life had gone. Gone just absolutely AWOL, and I had no idea what was going on. I identified as a father. I identified as a provider, and all of a sudden, I didn't have my kids around all the time, and and it was real rough on me.
Yeah.
And I someone showed interest, and I snap called, and like I was lost, and I married somebody I had no business marrying.
How many children did you have?
I have
from
two,
that previous
two from the previous marriage. My they're 25 and 21 currently. My son will be 22 in like 2 weeks, 3 weeks.
Steve, I won't lie, you look much younger than that.
I get that a lot. I'm catching up real quick though. The gray is coming in. it's the hairline's going back a little bit, but 25 and 22. And then now I met my current wife, Lindsay, in 2006, fall of 2006, friend of a friend, just introduced and just clicked right away. Just like I had gotten to the second marriage lasted about 3 years, which was about 3 years longer than it should have lasted. tried to make it work real hard. It was clear that it wasn't, and we both just said, "Yep, yeah, this is done." And then I kind of played the hermit for 10 years and
focused
on my kids, focused on my businesses, and because in the meantime I had opened a store right at the end of my second marriage. I had opened my store in Madison,
okay,
and had quit my full-time job at the divorce time. Like, that was actually a really pivotal moment in me as developing as a businessman. Was at the time I was working for a company called Bell and Howell. I was working on mail sorting machines at American Family Insurance.
Okay,
these are room-sized machines that take your insurance bill, print them, fold them up, slap them in an envelope, stamp them, sort them, send them to the mailhouse.
Wow, that sounds really impersonal.
It's and loud. I think I lost about 30% of my hearing in that job.
Wow.
So mail rooms are very loud. So whenever I say what, I blame Bill and Howell. actually, not them. They were very, very adamant about us wearing ear protection, but my problem was that I always wanted to be able to hear it better. So I would take out my earplug and lean my ear so that I could hear what was happening on the machine, because that you find problems because squeaks tell you that there's something wrong. Uh-huh. Like if the machine goes whoosh, 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 dink, you know, you're listening to that dink trying to find out the spot where it's at.
Okay.
And that's anyway. So I spent a lot of time running my ear back and forth across machines and they got me deaf. Anyway, that's something else. So I decided when my second marriage broke up, again, it was maybe a little bit on a tilt mode. I was just really unhappy with everywhere I was in every part of my life, except magic, except the events I was running. And
this was after your second marriage.
It was actually right at the end of my second marriage. So we were still together, and actually, I've told her, and I will tell the world. I give her all of the credit for me opening my first store, because. And many people who know me in the industry have been around for a long time. Her name is Marcy, and many of them know her. She talked me into opening a store. Like, 100% her. It sounded neat to me, and I liked the idea of it. But I've got a job. I've got a mortgage. I've got, you know, I make plenty of money at what I'm doing. I don't think I have it on my plate to be able to open a store.
Uh-huh.
And Marcy talked me into doing it. She's like, there isn't anybody better on the planet to do it than you. Madison needs a store. Two stores had just closed up, so there was a vacant hole on the side of Madison that I was on. And she's like, it should be you. And so she talked me into doing it with the idea that she was going to be managing it. She would run it for me. She didn't have a job at the time. She's like, I'll run it. I'll do the counter, and it'll be great. Well, then a month after we opened, there, like, all of the problems in our marriage got exacerbated by the stress of running a store.
Uh-huh.
And it's like, yep, this is done. And so she left, and there was looking at a store that I had just opened, that I had a 3-year lease on a store. I didn't have a manager. I had no way to. I had a full time job. I worked 50 plus hours a week at that job. And I had been running the store probably 20 to 25 hours a week for myself over the hours that she was able to run it. And I was sitting in the store. I'd taken a week off when my marriage broke up from my regular job, and was just sitting in my store because I was running that while I took my week off, trying to figure out how I was going to keep this thing going. And I realized I didn't want to go back to work. I don't want to. You know, you've seen Office Space, right?
Yeah,
It's like, you going into work today? No.
Okay.
Are you sick? Or something? No, I just don't want to. Like, the job was fine. I just didn't want to. So I didn't go back to work. I called my boss and said, you know, I'm done.
And this was a week? Like
over the course of a week from, it was like so early February, like February 5th is when she moved out. And it was that week, February 5th, 2001, is when I decided I didn't like my life the way it was and I was doing something about it.
What didn't you like? Can you talk us through that
decision? It's a very core, a corporate thing. Like I liked my job fine. I liked a couple of the people I worked with fine. I utterly despised a couple of the guys that I worked with. Like, I felt that they were just stains on the human race.
Okay.
You know, that sort of thing.
And
it was very difficult to work with them. And you know, with all of the things that they did to make the job more difficult for me. And like, if they weren't there, I would enjoy the job significantly better. and everybody has to deal with that. Every job is like that, and up to and including the stuff that I'm doing right now. Like, you have to deal with people you don't like on a daily basis. Yeah. But being self-employed, I got to choose those people a lot better. I'll tolerate that guy because I know that it's short term, that it's going to take care of it. But like day in, day out, working 8 hours a day next to this guy who you'd just rather punch in the face than work was rough. It was rough. Add to that, you know, unhappiness in life again, and just always having felt a little lost and never quite found my place in the world. Like, I did electronics because I was good at it.
Uh-huh.
It was not a passion for me. It was not a... I didn't go to college and get that degree because I felt some sort of calling to go work on circuits.
Uh-huh.
I had always been a tinkerer. I had always been a builder. I knew I was good at it, so that's what I did because I could do it. I didn't really find that passion until I started running Magic tournaments, which it also turns out apparently I'm pretty good at. So I did that, and I was so happy in this other life that I had. My 9-to-5, you know, it wasn't really 9-to-5, but my 9-to-5 uh-huh. job, the thing that I did for a living was the thing that I did for a living. The thing that I did to live was another job, which yeah. was organizing events and bringing hundreds of people together into a room to share an experience, something that I never had. Like, growing up, it was so difficult for me to find like groups of people that would come in and say, hey, we like this thing. We like the same thing as you. It's really cool. You know, we're talking 3 or 4 people at a time. I've put myself in this position where I could bring hundreds of people in the room who are all like, it doesn't matter whether you like, I don't like that guy or I like that guy. This is my group of friends, you know, but grand scheme of things, these 150 people, these 250 people that are all around, they're all like me. We all share something. We all want the same things. We're all fans of this thing. It's moving and it's fantastic and it's very powerful.
Yeah, I can definitely.
It's addictive.
Yes. I was a little skeptical about going to Gen Con. I mean, I'm a nerd. I've been a nerd for my whole life. But.
Is this your first year?
Yes, to Gen Con.
Welcome to Gen Con.
Yes, thank you. But I was a little intimidated by the amount of involvement in the culture.
Sure.
Cosplayers at
yeah,
the beginning
they concern
of Gen Con
you a little bit.
Were
yeah.
like, I was a little bit put off. Because I guess, I thought about this, I think I push back against people who want attention,
sure.
who are trying to get attention.
Sure.
And to me, cosplayers...
That feels like me. Yeah.
Cosplayers kind of did that, but I actually have changed my opinion.
But then you get to interact with them.
Yes, and it's just really remarkable.
Yeah.
The
level of passion involved
yes.
in cosplayers in general, and it's like every other group of people, right? There are generalizations, but every group of people has different levels of what it is that they're trying to get out of something or put into something. So there's you can't say one cosplayer is exactly the same as
yeah,
the other.
Yeah.
But as a group of people, these are such passionate fans, and they're just fans.
Yeah,
I think there's nothing wrong with that.
And the fact that they just do it for nothing,
yeah.
like it
well,
costs
they don't,
money.
Yeah, it costs them money. Yeah, I was gonna say
costumes.
They don't do it for nothing. They do it for negative.
No,
you know?
Yeah, that's what I yeah. mean. Like, it's an
yeah.
investment
at expense.
Yes,
they because it makes them happy. It's like any other hobby. I play Magic. It costs me money.
Yes,
but I play it because I like it. I play it because I get something out of it. Cosplayers, same thing, you know, they get something out of that as well. They, you know, they get to associate and attach themselves to something that makes them feel good.
Yes.
And what's wrong with that?
No, and that's yeah, and I totally had that kind of revelation at here at Gen Con.
Here.
I was like, everybody is just excited.
Yeah.
And the energy is just palpable,
yeah.
like it's contagious.
It's near overwhelming.
Yes.
Like the calm before the storm as they open the exhibit hall, like the crowds of people standing around it, and it's almost like a release the hounds
yeah.
moment when those doors go open and the people just flood in because they want to get to that booth to get that thing that they're, you know, there's only 500 today. And it's,
yeah.
It's exciting and it's neat. Yeah.
Changing gears a little bit.
Yoink.
That week that changed your life
right.
changed.
Yep.
Previous to that, how had, like, nerd culture kind of fit into, like, your previous marriage and...
My first marriage, it didn't at all.
Your children?
My first marriage, it didn't at all. She didn't understand it. She didn't get it. She didn't want to get it. She didn't care.
Okay. Was that ultimately one of the big...
Well, I'm sure, like, it wasn't one. It wasn't like I said, and you don't like my game either.
Yeah.
But it certainly has to have affected how things were going. It was so we split in '96. And so I'd been playing for a couple of years. I hadn't started running Pro Tours yet, but I was running something called SPAM, which was Sun Prairie Area Magic Club.
Okay.
And we met every Saturday night at the community center in Sun Prairie, and we played games. We just played Magic. We just played tons and tons of Magic. We organized a league structure. We did all kinds of fun stuff with it. And it was me and a handful. A guy named Wes Bashirs was involved in that. He was actually the original driver of it. And then I came in with a guy named Chris Bowles, who still lives in Sun Prairie and is a good friend of mine. And he came in with me, and the two of us really sort of took it over and ran it when Wes decided that he was too busy to do things.
Okay.
And it just kind of grew from there. We ran tournaments a couple times a year as sort of fundraisers for our club so that we could get our club members cool stuff. And that was my first tournament that I ran was for SPAM.
Okay.
And it was a fundraiser. We held it at a VFW, and I think we got like 150 people. Back in the day, there was no internet, or the internet was really, really a fledgling thing.
Uh-huh.
And certainly not everybody was on it. Like a couple people, maybe AOL. AOL was out. You could get on AOL. There were some groups there and stuff. But certainly wasn't as pervasive as it is now. Pervasive, is that the right word?
Yeah.
It's everywhere. Like,
yeah.
You touch it in a daily life. I'm touching it right now.
Yeah.
So it was harder to get the word out about these sorts of things. So what I did, and it meshed well with my job, which was the video game thing. I drove a route a lot of times. They would, like, each day I would go somewhere in the state and fix something and move something. So as I drove around the state, I would stop in various hobby stores. And
okay.
I would stop and say, hey, I'm going to be running this Magic tournament in blah. If you'd like me to put your name and address on this thing as a promotional piece, I'll put flyers out at all of these stores. Give me 10 or 15 bucks of stuff to give away as a prize, and I'll put your name on a store, on the
store.
So I'd spread out all these flyers all over southern Wisconsin and northern Illinois. And we'd get 15 or 20 stores to sign up and say, you know, here's 10 bucks worth of stuff to give away. And we charged, you know, some crappy little entry fee, like, you know, $5 or something.
Uh-huh.
And then we'd give away hundreds and hundreds of dollars worth of stuff. So people would come in from all over the place. But, grand scheme of things, after the hall rental and everything, I'd make $100 to throw at the club. What we'd do with that was we'd go buy supplies, you know, we'd buy little cards and we could print everybody's name on and,
okay,
you know, like, and your rank, because we had rankings. Like, when you were in it so long and you played games, you reported your matches, you'd have a level, basically. And so you'd be a level whatever sorcerer. And, you know, we did all that stuff. We did Planeswalker points back in 95.
Before they were cool.
Yeah. So.
And then, so were you doing that previous, like, during your first marriage?
Yep. And that was happening during the first.
And
yep.
Then your children, how did nerd culture kind of fit into?
Well,
they
were
your
young.
Wife doesn't so didn't I seem have, like
she didn't really, she didn't I, much. My kids uh-huh. my kids watched Star Wars pretty early.
Okay.
Indiana Jones. I remember one time, and if he hears this, he's going to hate me for it. My son was 4 years old. His mom and I had just split. I was in an apartment, and uh-huh. we'd gone shopping, and we came back, and John, who is he was four, maybe he was five. Had been humming the Indiana Jones theme,
okay,
all day, and I was finally like, "All right, John. I mean, I like it too, but that's enough. Let's move on to something else." And so he says, or maybe it's the Star Wars theme. Anyway, he says, "Okay," and I'm like, "Take this block of cheese and go put it in the fridge." And he goes, "Block of cheese, block of cheese, block of cheese." So as a five-year-old, he was pretty well immersed in that.
Uh-huh.
And the songs running through his head were theme music to my fantasy movies. And it was pretty cool. So there,
I bet you were so proud.
It was a very proud moment. I almost cried. So they were involved in that on that level, but neither one of them turned into really geeks that much. John does a lot of video game stuff, but he doesn't. He's played a little D&D. He's dabbled in Magic, but he's not really done that. He's found his passion is music. He plays guitar and he's good at it. So
okay,
yeah,
that's good that he found. I mean,
everybody's got to find their thing. You know?
Yeah, and you have a daughter too.
I have a daughter, actually two daughters. I have an older daughter who's 25, and then my newest daughter is two.
Two, yes.
Yeah, so 25, 21, and two, with a new one on the way in January.
And what's the difference between raising your two children who are 25 and 21,
the two decades
and,
apart.
Yeah, what's
so
been,
I've had this discussion with people in the past, and the thing that I came up with is when I was raising the first one, I had all the energy in the world and no patience. This one, I have all the patience in the world and no energy. I wish it'd be I think somewhere in the middle would be about right. But it's still pretty fantastic. They're very different experiences. Raising a child when you're 23 is significantly different than raising a child when you're 45.
Yeah, I would imagine.
There's a lot of difference. As a young man, I worked hard, but I didn't have a whole lot of money. It was a paycheck to paycheck. It was, you know, as days went on, it was, you know, they're like, well, hopefully we ain't rent this month. You know, that the struggles that a lot of people have. As I've gotten older, you know, my kids grown, moved out of the house before I started my next set of family. So, you know, as you get older, it gets easier. Uh-huh. You know, you have the things you want. You don't need to buy as many things. You just get better at living. You know, as you get older, you tend to make a little bit more money. So it got easier. Raising Evelyn, I never have to worry. Like, there were times and I'm like, I don't have enough money, that I'm worrying about daycare costs and all that sort of stuff. And it's been nicer. I make enough money now that rarely do I have to worry about taking care of her and giving her the things that I want.
Okay.
And that's been real nice.
And what was the decision? What went into the decision to have your newest daughter?
I met Lindsay in 2006. And she's younger than I am, and when we met, we clicked well, and we had a very, here's another one. She'll probably hate me for talking about this online. We had a really open discussion very early on after we had met, like within days, because we both realized it was there. It had clicked.
Uh-huh.
And I said, you know, I'm older than you, maybe you didn't notice, but and we need to talk about if we're gonna, like, I don't want to stay in this and get hooked and then end up breaking both of us later because we can't get the things out of life that we want. So uh-huh. Let's have a discussion right now about, are there possibilities in this relationship before one of us ends up getting hurt because we can't get something out of it that we want? And we had that discussion early on. Was it a possibility? Yes, it was a possibility. A lot of things had to line up for me, but was it a possibility? Absolutely. She's been awesome, and I love her fiercely, and I love her deeply, and I would give her anything she wants.
Cool. Yeah. And so, kind of going back, I like to jump around a lot.
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah, you got an edit button.
Yeah. the store, when you opened it,
yep.
How did it reflect who you were? Like, what kind of thought processes went into that? Like, how does it reflect your personality?
It reflects my personality because we did it on not enough budget.
Okay.
In too little time.
All right.
And without enough knowledge.
Creativity, restrictions breed creativity, right?
Yeah. Hard work.
Yes.
You know, I leaned into it and put a lot of work into it. I didn't know enough, so I had to work harder.
Okay.
I've since learned, I learned so much in the first couple of years. I learned a lot about myself. I learned a lot about the industry. I learned a lot about people. I've always been reasonable with, you know, dealing with people for somebody who grew up not really having a lot of social interaction. Uh-huh. I just always have seemed to have been able to feel well and move in. My empathy button works well.
Uh-huh.
I learned so much more about people in the first 2 years of opening Misty Mountain in Madison than I had learned the rest of my life. So I learned so much about myself in those first couple of years and a lot more about people and what they need and what they expect and what they really mean. Because a lot of times somebody will tell you something, but they actually mean something else.
What were some of those things that you learned?
I think it might be too intangible to talk about other than just, okay. I don't know if it's possible to tell you. I've had this discussion with a lot of people. Like, you, when I'm hiring somebody to do a job for me, if that job has to be interacting with people, I can teach you math. I can teach you how to fix something. I can teach you how to run a program. I can teach you how to, there's a lot of things I can teach you. One of the things that it's really, really difficult, if not impossible to teach is how to handle people, how to talk to people, how to get out of them what you need. So if you've got a job that needs a lot of personal interaction, you find the guy who's good at that part of it, and then you teach him the rest of it.
Okay.
When I say guy, I mean guy or girl.
Yeah.
I have a lot of women on my staff at GPs, and the reason that the people are in there is because because they're good at talking to people and getting the things to them that they need.
Okay.
And it's a really, really difficult. It's a hard nut to crack.
Yeah. What do you carry? Like, what's your store like? Those who haven't been, myself.
My store in Madison, I sold. I don't know if that come up. I only have one store now. I had opened another store in 2006. Actually, right before I met Lindsay, I had opened the store in Minneapolis. That's where I met her. She lived in Minneapolis when I met her. The store in Madison, I opened in 2001. We're a pretty typical hobby store. We sell board games. We sell miniature games. We sell card games. I don't do a lot of extra fluff. When I originally opened, I had a LAN center. I had computers. We played a lot of Diablo. We played a lot of Counter-Strike.
Okay.
I had that for quite a while. That's pretty much it. Various collectible and non-collectible card games, board games, and miniature games. Straight down the line, I didn't do juggling supplies. I didn't do model rockets. All just straight games.
Okay. And when did you start Legion? Like, when did you start to branch out?
Legion was my thing. Legion was the name of the company that I made when I started running PTQs back in 97. So that was my name first. I chose to use a different name for my store originally.
That was Misty Mountain.
Okay. Yeah. Back in the day because I had a partner when I came into that store. I had a guy who came in as a 50-50 co-owner. I put in all the work. He put in half the money.
Okay.
And
it seemed like you that was an equitable relationship.
It was a good deal. It was a good deal. I needed him. He didn't put in as many hours at the work, but I needed him. I needed his bit of money. I also needed somebody to occasionally work the weekends when I had to go run a PTQ. Without him, it never would have happened. So regardless of how much respective work we put into the store, I couldn't have done it without him. So how much work I put into it would not have mattered.
Okay.
And I think a lot of people get lost in that sometimes. They're like, well, he's only putting in 10%. You know, I feel terrible that I'm putting in 90% and he's putting in 10%. Like, but could you do the thing you did if he did not give his 10%?
Yeah, yeah.
Then maybe he's giving a little bit more than it feels like, even if it is only, you know, like we work 60 hours a week and he only works 6 of them, or we're open 60 hours a week and he only does 6 of them. Is he actually really giving me more than those 6 hours? The answer is probably yes.
Uh-huh.
If nothing else, just like getting a day off. Which was really rare early days. Occasionally I'd like, Dave, I'm Bert, I need a day. He'd come in and work a day for me so I could. Cool. He'd take a day off of his job and come in and work for me. So, where the heck was that going? What was it like opening the store? Just a ton of hard work. And we opened that store in 2001 and it went really well. Okay. We opened it, like I said before, on a shoestring budget, way less money than we should have. And I had some bonuses. I knew a lot of people. A lot of people knew me. I could say, hey, I'm opening a store, and they would come. I gave a home to the Magic community who had been without a home because there was no place for them to play. There's a thing in Madison weekly. I did the one in Sun Prairie on Saturday. There was another one in Madison every Wednesday night. There's been something until a couple of years ago. There was a Magic. They called it Guild. Every Wednesday night, a bunch of guys would get together and draft. And this went on for 15 years.
Wow.
From the early days up until a couple of years ago, it just lost a little steam finally and went away. But it was every Wednesday night. People still called it Guild up till a couple of years ago. And
what happened to it?
I think just a changeover of people and enough different places opened up that they could play. It used to be there was only one place to play, so everybody would focus there. But now there are 4 stores in Madison where there are play space, 5 stores maybe.
Okay.
Just things change over time and the focus isn't there. It used to be you had to go there if you wanted to play other people.
Uh-huh.
Now you don't have to. So when I opened my store, Guild had a place again. They'd been meeting in the basement of one of the guys' apartment complexes.
Okay.
So I said, hey, bring Guild here. And they showed up and they played. And so I had a built-in crowd from the day I turned my first key.
Nice.
Yeah, so that without that, I wouldn't make it. Like, without that built-in crowd, I'd have never made it. We had enough money for first month's rent. If we didn't make enough money in first month's rent, we were not opening for the second month.
Wow.
It's dumb. By the way, those of you listening at home, do not do it that way.
And what surprised you about
it? Surprised me that it worked.
It worked.
Yeah. I had no retail experience. None. Not a dot. I'd never worked a retail job in my life. The only job I've not done. I've done a ton of jobs, from shoveling out hog barns to working on medical robotics. Like, I covered a gamut of a lot of jobs, and I had never worked retail. So I had no experience.
What did you figure out that you were bad at?
Retail.
Really? It doesn't sound
I'm not real good at it. I shouldn't say that. I worked okay, and but I don't believe I'm actually that good at retail. I got where I was got on customer service. I got where I got on providing people what they needed. There are a lot of people who do significantly better job of retail than I do. I can name dozens of store who are better as a retail outlet than I am.
Okay.
I can name a half a dozen off the top of my head. But,
I'll take your word for it.
Yeah. It's a specific skill. It's a thing. And if those of you who have a good retailer in your location, and I mark a good retailer by providing the things you want when you want them, giving you the things you need, having the stuff that's going to be cool before it's cool. Like, all of these little pieces that have to go together to make a good retail store, that count your lucky stars. That's a hard job. And a lot of people fail at it.
And you seem to be doing okay.
I got by, but again, what I felt I lacked for in some of the skills that other people had, I tried to make up in hard work. I've never been afraid to pull up the sleeves. It's something that comes from my upbringing, I'm sure, but it's just always something I've been able to do. Like, I'll just put my head down and work harder. Find people that know what they're doing and ask them questions.
Okay. And so you opened your store in 2003, correct?
2001 in Madison and 2006 in Minneapolis.
Okay. And then had you been running events?
Yep.
The whole time?
The whole time. I ran my first PTQ in 97. I ran my first sanction tournament in 94.
And were you running that as a separate company?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
And that's
where I was going before. Okay. I was starting to say why the store doesn't have, like, why didn't I just not call it Legion Games to start with? Back in the day, PTOs, premier tournament organizers, which is what I was, had gotten to be a bit of a dirty word. Stores didn't like that premier organizers existed. Those of us who had stores made people even madder. Today, what's happened today is now any store owner could be running a PTQ or a pre-release.
Yeah.
So that has changed, and it's not something to worry about. But I wanted to separate the businesses because I didn't want somebody to go to be giving the grief. Like, they all knew that I owned both of them, but calling it the same thing, I felt, gave me a little bit, maybe an unfair advantage as far as like the association. And I didn't want other stores. I've always been very community based. I feel community, and I think community is hugely important. I've always gotten along well in the various communities I have. There's always exceptions. You know, sometimes you just don't get along with people. Like I mentioned about the other job, a guy I just didn't get along with. That happens in stores too. But for the most part, I get along really, really well with all of the guys in my area. When I say guys, I don't mean that in a sexist way. I say guys as a generic.
Uh-huh.
All the people in my area. Like, one of the guys in my area is Lori, who's in Pegasus, and she runs a great store. She runs the first store I bought a Magic Pack at. You know,
cool.
Like, I bought D&D books there. Like, they've been around since like 81 or 82 or something like that. A long, long time. And it's a great store. And we need those stores. I've always been a proponent of, you know, I don't want to get more of the pie. I want to make more pie. I believe that's a absolute hard, fast, best way to do it in retail, hobby retail for sure. There are so much potential for more gamers out there.
Uh-huh.
So why would we fight over the 10 gamers that we have? Why don't we make 15 gamers?
Yes, absolutely. It's funny that you say that, because I live a very similar philosophy that I got from Michael Moore.
You're in KC, which has a fantastic community.
Yes.
Fantastic community down there. Steve Farrell and Lloyd, like all the guys down there, all the stores that are there that get along so great. Still doing the coalition pre-releases,
yes,
right? All the stores come together and do a regional pre-release. That's fantastic.
Yeah. By the way, everybody, if you want to come to a regional pre-release, you can come to Kansas City.
Hundreds and hundreds of people.
Yes.
Like,
I think they
just
had
like old
400
school. Yeah. That's
at
awesome.
The Return to Ravnica pre-release.
Yeah. It makes me warm and squishy inside thinking about it.
But yeah, what I was saying, Michael Moore says about documentary filmmaking, rising tide raises all ships.
Yep.
So why squabble over that? Yeah, exactly. What do you think of that? what do you think of that change from kind of defanging the PTOs,
right,
and giving all those events to the...
So there's a couple of lines on that.
The stores.
There's... it's hard to argue with results.
Okay.
And we're a couple of years under that belt. And look what's happened with Magic. Like, you can't count it just as that. There are a lot of things that they've done, and they've done really, really well. They released a couple of very popular sets. They...
Duels of the Planeswalkers. Huge.
Holy cow, huge. Like, as a guy who has a store, I was running a store when that came out. The amount of people who were re-enfranchised in the Magic brand thanks to Duels of the Planeswalkers is phenomenal. Like, guys I hadn't seen come to a PTQ in 7-8 years walk in my door, and I'm like, holy cow, where did you come from? It's like, man, I was playing Xbox the other day, and I have Magic on there. I was like, man, I forgot how much I love this game.
Yeah.
And they're back. I was like, what's changed? I was like, well, not much has changed.
Planeswalkers.
Everything
points,
has changed. I mean, that's the really cool thing.
Damage on the stack.
But it still plays the same.
Generally.
Like, in the real grand scheme of things, a guy who hasn't played in years can sit down, and even though there are technically differences in the rules, it still plays just the
you
same.
You still tap your mana.
Everything's
you still
the
play
same.
Your creatures. Yep. You still attack.
It's awesome. And that Duels was such a coup de grace.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like, finish him, Duels of the Planeswalkers. There it is. Now you're going to get them all back. So I believe all these things happened and all of them raised it. A lot of that, I think, is on the back of moving the premier play to the communities. I agree with that. I wish things had changed a little bit differently. I still waffle about whether PTQs should be there or not. I don't know. I can make an argument on both sides of it.
Yeah. I mean, you can have... I think of, like, Cash in Kansas City. Collector's Cash runs a great PTQ.
Absolutely.
They're also supported by a really great...
A community.
And a really great... Feral oftentimes has a hand in those PTQs.
Yep.
However, I think of other areas, and I'll leave this...
Leave that
I
one
won't
blank.
Name names. But there's one particular city that has... That if it were not for this new store that just opened up, would have terrible PTQs.
Right. So it's an interesting problem. When the PTQ thing's first happening, it's a bitter spill to swallow, obviously, for me. They've moved things around. I've fared well. They're like, don't cry for me.
Uh-huh.
Things have been okay in my life of the being. I did lose a lot of stuff, but I got a lot of stuff back. I was fortunate enough to be one of the people that they kept on as a PTO to run GPs. So my GP presence has stepped up. I've got a few more of those, and they're fantastic. I really love running those. I miss running the PTQs a lot. So what I was saying before is I agree 100%, 100,000% about the pre-release going to store level. That's an event that should be there. It really helps give players a better sense of community on that thing, that buzz. Keep it local, keep it vibrant. Should there be quite as many as there are? I don't know. Maybe there should be a few less, but I'm not going to quibble about numbers. There should have been more than there were. I don't think anybody should have to drive 7 hours to get to a pre-release. And I think opening up to the point where there could be one within an hour or two of everybody in the country was exactly what needed to happen. Again, you can make arguments on either side for the. I don't think you can argue the pre-releases.
Really like regional.
The regional ones. Yep.
And I would. Maybe argue.
Yeah,
I definitely disagree. But I mean, I do think I see their value at the store level.
Yep.
But
buzz factor is really awesome.
Yeah,
So the cool thing about it is now that we've moved to these Grand Prix that are running around and Star City opens and TCUBR 5Ks. You know, there are bigger events that are coming in the wake of that because people do want that buzz, that festival feel.
Yes.
There's absolutely a place for that. But as far as a tool for enfranchising players, I think having that that be at a store level, I don't think there's anything better for getting players in the game and getting them a reason to stay in the game. And adding a 6-hour drive or a 4-hour drive to somebody's involvement to stay in the game makes it harder to keep them in the game. So,
yeah.
And I think a pre-release is a really, beyond Duels of the Planeswalkers, pre-releases are probably the best acquisition tool for getting somebody involved in organized play. Once you can hook them, they can stay there. Now we can take them to PTQs. Now we can take them to GPs. But that gateway drug of a pre-release, I think, is important to be accessible.
Yeah. But what about those players that wouldn't ever go to a Grand Prix Like, what regional events do they have? That was my problem with them getting rid of the regional pre-releases, is because, yeah, sure, you can say, well, there's more Grand Prix, but, like, Joe Schmo, who just plays his green deck at the kitchen table, does he want to go to a Grand Prix? I don't think so.
He doesn't, but he probably doesn't need to.
Well, no, I know, but what about the regional events for him?
Yeah, yeah. So here's my theory on it, my take on it, and I get this is all my opinion. Don't anybody think
this is also my opinion.
This is good. This is coming from any sort of higher power than this. This is all my opinion, and I have disagreements all over the world. I mean, we have a little disagreement here, but I believe this is the sort of thing that's amazing for it. Discourse without being you're a jerk and you're wrong.
Yeah. Well, you are a jerk. I am wrong,
but that's fine. I'm a jerk and I'm wrong, but they're completely separate. Actually, I'm a jerk. I admit it, but it's not about this.
Steve's a really nice guy.
I always say people. I've been called a lot of names over the years, and whenever somebody calls me a name that doesn't fit, I get irate about it. Like, I am not. I was recently called a liar. I am many things.
Yeah,
I'm a jerk. You can edit this if you need to. I can be an asshole. I am not a liar.
That's one thing that people don't understand about the Magic community is that you don't become really as successful. You don't become successful, especially in the business sense. I mean, you can have players that become really successful and are really dubious. But
running the seat on that side doesn't get you anywhere.
This community doesn't tolerate that.
You get eviscerated.
Yes. and you get taken out by other people. Like, yeah.
There are instances where that has gone on longer than anybody would have expected, but it does all eventually. The chickens do come home to roost most of the time.
Yeah.
Anyway, so what I'm saying about the pre-release is it's much like the growth thing, right? So there are people who want to go to the festival thing. There are people that want to do that. There's a certain sub percentage of the population of Magic players who think Gen Con is awesome, who think going to a GP with 1,200 people or recently 4,500 people is awesome. That is a percentage of the population of Magic players. How do you get that percentage of population of Magic players up? You make more Magic players. If we have 100,000 Magic players and 10% of them think going on the road and day tripping to go do a big event is cool, we're talking about 10,000 of these people that are willing to do it. Wait a minute. What numbers did I say? Did I just do my math right? Doesn't matter. Let's just say 10,000. 10,000 of the 100. Yeah. The point is relevant. What happens when we get 1 million of them?
True.
Now we have 100,000 people that we're talking about as that pool of people, because there's only a certain percentage of people who are going to be willing to do that. Like, it's hard to convert somebody from a kitchen table Magic player to a competitive, but somebody who's willing to go be in a room of 1,200 people.
Yeah.
I think it's fantastic, and I think anybody should try it. Everybody should try it. Some people, it's just not going to trip them. It's not going to hit their thing. And that's completely okay. There are kitchen table Magic players. There are store level Magic players. There are regional Magic players. There are world level Magic players. Yeah. And it's okay to find that. And you should stop at whatever level you feel comfortable at. I only ever want to play in my kitchen and play an EDH with my brother-in-law. Awesome. I want to play against John Finkel in the World Championship. Awesome.
Yeah.
Try, go after it. Hit the level that you're trying to go to. There's a place for everybody, and there's a spot for everybody. And the more accessible we make everything about Magic, the more we encourage people to play the game, the more people we get to share this thing that we love with, that fan base. I met you because of Magic.
Uh-huh.
I didn't know you a year ago.
It's true.
I just had supper in Madison with a bunch of friends, most of whom don't actually play Magic actively anymore, and they're among my closest friends. I was in Madison for overnight to help do some stuff at my son's house and was hanging out there. And I was like, hey, guys, let's go get supper. And I was sitting around and I'm like, I've known you for 12 years. I've known you for 17 years. I've known you for 10 years. You first came into my store when you were 14 and I almost kicked you out because I thought you stole something. You know, going around the table, here's my relationship with all these people. Yeah. And every single one of them had touched because of Magic. All of them play at least casually. On some level, but very few of them play regularly, like weekly, actively, uh-huh. competitively. But we're all still fans and we all still play, but we didn't talk about Magic at all.
Yeah, yeah.
We sat at this restaurant and we sat around and it like, so it was just like this moment of zen for me, right? I'm like, one of those things where you feel how small the world is, that I know these people because of this game and they brought these wonderful people into my life. Maybe I'd have met other wonderful people with something else, but I'm happy that it was Magic that did it. I'm happy that I know them because of this, because I know the kind of people they are, because they share the same passions as me. So the pre-releases, I think, help people find those things. And if you raise that bar saying you have to drive 4 hours to get to it, and now you have your awesome regional pre-release, and by the way, people still don't have to drive 4 hours to get to a store, because just outside of Kansas City is another store running a one that's going to hold 20 people.
Oh, yeah. And that's what I think there's a... I think there's room for both. I mean, I think there could be.
Tried for a little while. Like when they first started transitioning, we had regional pre-releases, and then they allowed store pre-releases. And everybody remembers that. And it was pretty cool, and it did it, but it was complicated for the players. It was complicated for them to understand the differences and what was happening. So I believe to bring a more seamless event to the players, WotC made a corporate decision to say, we're supporting pre-releases in this way because it's easier to maintain the message and and provide the sort of experience we're trying. Kansas City is so fantastically different because you guys all said, we still want to do this,
yeah,
and we're putting in the work, and we're making the thing, and we're communicating to the players, and we're taking that out and doing this ourselves. It's a unique, special, sparkle pony kind of thing.
I think it's also a credit to Lloyd.
To Lloyd. Where I mentioned before.
And Steve Farrell. Like, I want to give Steve all of... Like,
absolutely.
I will give Steve all of my money.
Yep. And it's not just because he'll point a tank at you.
Yeah, and it's... my listeners know, Steve Farrell is a old tournament organizer from Kansas City, who I think he has 9 or 10 kids.
He's got about 50, I think.
He is in the Army, and then he has also raised a small Army.
Yes, a baseball team at least.
But yeah, he's a family man. Like, he's just incredible.
He's a
like,
good guy. Among the good guys, he's certainly one of them. So I've known him a long time. We used to joke. He was always like, I'm the Steve of the South. I was Steve of the North. He was Steve of the South. And every once in a while, we'd get emails for the wrong one. Like, WotC would send out an email meant for him, and they would send it to me, or vice versa. Uh-huh. He's like, oh, you meant the Steve to the North. I'll forward it on to him. And it's because of that community. Steve and very for certain, without question, Lloyd is a very strong player on that stage. He's such a gem for your community.
Oh, yeah.
Holy cow, that guy, the nicest guy on the planet. Steve Farrell's nice, and Lloyd takes it to, like, the power of 10.
Yeah.
And he's just... he's never said a mean word in his life, as far as I know. I don't know how somebody is that happy all the time. I'm not going to suggest what could possibly be going on, but he's he's very happy all the time. It seems like it must be some kind of illegal.
So you mentioned earlier that you had one of the Pegasus games.
Yep.
Is ran by Laura?
Lori. Yeah.
Lori.
Yep.
Did she run it when you first walked in and bought your first D&D book?
Well, there were two locations, and I don't think she was running in there, but she definitely, she was the owner of the store. I think there's two or three owners. Maybe they've sold through. Maybe it's just her now. I don't remember the structure, but they had two locations at the time, and I would go to the State Street location, and she was definitely not there the first time, but she has been there, like, over the years.
So you knew her really, really early?
I knew her early. I didn't know her real well. I mean, I knew who she was. Everybody knows who she was. If you live in Madison, you know who Lori Aiken is. Uh-huh. You just know. Because she's a staple. She's been running there for 3 decades.
Uh-huh.
Like, it's a long time.
And what is she, what's that like? What's her vantage point of, like, seeing you grow up?
Well,
that's
so,
pretty incredible to have this little kid who was... coming in to buy D&D books.
Oh, no. It's not the same area. I was 20 when I walked. Like, 20,
oh, really?
22.
Okay.
I moved to Madison well after. Like, I didn't move to Madison until 88, 89.
Oh, okay. All right.
88. And so she certainly didn't see me grow up. But when I opened my store, like, we were familiar. I'd run tournaments for them before I opened my store. Like, they used to do a game day, and I went out and ran some tournaments for them. So we knew each other, and we were familiar with each other. So when I opened my store, I said, hey, I'm opening a store. And I'll let you know, this is happening. And she's always, because she's an awesome lady, she's always been supportive and just, you know, do it right.
Uh-huh.
You know, like,
We build open your store on.
That's not the right she's talking about. She's talking about the customer service, right?
Yeah.
And that's been something that we've pushed hard. And since then, you know, a handful of stores are opened up, and she's actually got it real rough on the west side. A whole bunch of stores, like there's two other stores who are both also awesome that are on her side of the thing, her side of town, but they're all doing it right. And we're all making more gamers. I think it just stands to show the exact sort of thing I'm talking about. There's room for more. There are four good game stores on the west side of Madison. Metro area is like 250 or 300,000 people.
Wow.
There are four good game stores on the west side of Madison. How awesome is that?
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
And it's important for the community to keep working together. If you have the bad seed, if you have the guy who is like, oh, I'm just going to price gouge and knock everybody out of business and then it'll all be mine, it'll never be yours.
Uh-huh.
It will never be yours, because if that's the sort of community that your players end up expecting, there will be somebody coming in behind you. Once you become the establishment, if you start playing Kingmaker and Mafia, you know, that's the way it ends up going. There will be somebody else. Somebody else will come down and do that to you. Everybody getting along makes more gamers. Everybody making more gamers makes everybody money. Gaming makes a lot of money. There are so much money involved in here, but it's a drop in the bucket when you look at how much money is available when you start looking at other hobbies. Like our competition, as a game store with PlaySpace, my competition isn't Walmart, it isn't Target, it's AMC Theaters.
Yeah,
it's what used to be Blockbuster, not so much anymore. You know, maybe Redbox.
Yeah. Speaking of gamers, seamless transition.
Zoink.
One thing that I like to talk about with a lot of my guests is being a gamer, nerd, geek, and social life. When you started running events, or even when you started really like getting older and more socially self-aware, were you one to kind of gloss over what you did on the weekends when people would ask you, or when you would go on dates, would you, when they said, hey, what are you into, would you say, oh, I paint cars or something? I fixed things.
I have a very specific small bits of stories to kind of speak to that directly. My family, like, they get it and they understand it, you know, not necessarily specific. I have a nephew now who's actually starting to get really involved in Magic, and, you know, I've kind of given him a hookup on a couple of things, and he's starting to play. And it's kind of fun to see him grow up into it. And, you know, he's the same age as my son, but he's just decided he travels a lot, and it's nice because, you know, he finds some place to play in any town.
Yeah.
That's really awesome. So he's kind of getting into it. But when I was – so between – My second wife was super supportive of the hobby. She got it. She saw it. She thought it was neat. She even learned how to play a little bit. And that was all kind of – she's the one that encouraged me to open the store. So obviously, like, she thought the whole culture of it was real neat. After that marriage broke up, you know, and I took a little time off. And then I said, all right, I think I'm ready to get back into the pool. Maybe I'll start dating again. And I'm looking for women my age, right? Like, I've had my family. I've ended up meeting someone who I ended up making family part due again, but that was not my original intention. I was like, you know, my kids are done. I'm looking for somebody to meet. And so I would talk to women my age, and they're like, oh, well, what do you do? It's like, well, I run a game store. I'm sorry, you do what? I sell games. I run tournaments for a game called Magic, and they're like, what is that? And I'm like, so ultimately the only comparison you can draw when somebody doesn't, like, it's sad, Magic being the first, and I think the best, that I have to tell them, well, you know, like Pokemon or Yu-Gi-Oh, you've heard of those? I'm like, oh, yeah, my son plays that, or my nephew, or, and I'm like, well, it's kind of like that, but it's the first game that came out like it, and they're kind of based on it. So that's the thing that I do. And they're like, huh? Not a lot of second dates.
Oh, man.
So I ultimately decided I was just done with women. I had been done for quite a while. I had dated on and off, and I hadn't found the right person. I was like, you know, I'm just done. I'll be a bachelor. And that's when I met Lindsay, and things clearly changed. And the right person, you know?
And what did she think? Like, how did you guys meet?
She is... she worked with Mark Duda, who currently manages my store in Minneapolis or Burnsville, Minnesota. He worked with her at a call center where they did like phone bank calls where they do surveys.
Okay.
So like that was a part-time job for her while she was going to college. And then when she was done with college, she just kind of was still doing that and living in Minneapolis. And she worked with Mark, with Duda. So we met at a mutual friend's birthday party. Funny enough, the guys whose birthday party we met at was the guy who ended up managing my store down in Madison. I moved him down there from Minneapolis a couple years later to manage my store in Madison. And then in April, I just sold it to him. So the guy whose birthday party was at, who I was introduced to by my current store, my manager in Minneapolis, now owns the store in Madison. I sold it to him in April. So,
small world.
Yeah, this weird thing happens. But it was at his birthday party we met, and it just, there were a lot of other guys more her age there. And I'm like, look, she's gorgeous and she's single. Why aren't any of you moving on this? And I won't call out any names, but you know who you are. They were like, nah, blah this reason, blah that reason. And we ended up talking. And then the next week, all those guys came down. And Duda brought a message to me from her. And I was like, I got her number. And we started texting after that. And then it was phone calls. And then it was, you know, IMs. And it was, and then next thing I know, I have an amazing wife and an awesome daughter. Sweet. And it's been 6 years. Everything in my life is coming up Millhouse.
Cool. Well, now that that part of your life is going very well, story is kind of wrapped up.
Here we are. That brings us to, I guess, the most recent addition to my company family is Legion Supplies, which you asked me at the beginning. Let's talk about Fertile Circle.
Sure.
You said, hey, well, this Legion Supplies thing. And I was like, man, it does not start there. So Legion Supplies, I started in 2009. I'd been looking for sleeves to do as a promotion for a GP.
Okay.
Or even just PTQ. It was like, could I get a handful of 100 packs printed that I could give out at a PTQ or something like that, you know, with branding on them. I thought it would be a great marketing idea. Nobody would do it. I talked to a handful of companies who are already making stuff in the States, and I either got crazy high numbers of quotes with ridiculous prices or no contact back at all. A couple of the instances.
That's a way to run your company, I guess.
Right. Well, if they can't do it, they can't do it. It would have been nice to say, sorry, we can't do it.
Sorry, but, we can't. Like, but, yeah. Communicate that.
Correct.
Like, don't just...
Again, my levels of customer service, I feel that's something that's a no-brainer, but maybe it isn't always. So I ended up getting flown out to Kuala Lumpur for the Pro Tour there, the one that Finkel won. And that was really fun to watch, by the way.
Okay.
Because they brought me out to help with the side events. I'd been running some of the events for WOTC. I ran Pro Tours at the side events at the Pro Tours when they had them between 2006 and whenever they quit. And they brought me out to Kuala Lumpur to be there because the guys that were running the side events had never done anything like that before. I was basically an insurance policy.
Okay.
Here, if stuff starts catching on fire and blowing up, jump in there and fix it. So I gave them a lot of advice. I gave them some ideas about, you know, here, run this, run that. You know, maybe that would be more efficient if you did it this way. And it was a lot of fun. I met a lot of really cool people. One of the people I met turned me on to a factory in Taiwan who currently wasn't represented in the States. Like, they didn't have any property out here. They were pretty new. They're actually kind of leftovers from an old Ultra Pro factory. Like, some people that used to work there had got some machines and when they started making this stuff. And so he said, hey, I know these guys. You're talking about these sleeves. Because I was talking with him about my idea for that. And he's like, go talk to these guys. So I started talking to them. And they're like, yeah, we can do small runs. So we did a small run. I mean, it was still more than I wanted to make. But I justified it. It's like, all right, let's try it. Maybe it'll be awesome. And I did. And the sleeves that came back were fantastic. They were just really
sweet.
Good. So we gave those away at GP Minnesota 2009. Those are the ones with like the little Legionnaire. We made like RK posted the art for me that I put on him. It's kind of a Legionnaire chick and like an elf Legionnaire. It's kind of cool.
Okay.
He did the art for him. We printed those out. They were great. Everybody loved them. We made deck. But I still see the deck boxes floating around to this day. Like, they're all worn. Like, the pictures have been almost worn off of them, but the Velcro still sticks and they're not broken. Just, I still see them every event. I've seen three of them out here.
Sweet.
From so.
And that was in
4 years ago. 2009, fall of 2009. And so it was kind of this moment, like, I must bring this to the world, right? So I just, like, these are awesome. Why isn't anybody doing these? So as a store owner, right about that time, the world ran out of black sleeves. Plain, black, gloss sleeves. You know, the number one thing Magic players play.
Yeah. What
Ultipro was out. Max was out. Fantasy Flight was out. Player's Choice was out. KMC was out. You couldn't get a black sleeve from any of the five distributors I tried for about a month and a half.
Did nobody knows why?
They all just ran. It's just one of those weird coincidences where everybody, like, production weird thing. Maybe there was a growth spurt. They ran out. But as a store owner, I tried all of these different distributors, and none of them had them. I'm like,
whoa!
I'm going to call those guys that did those promos for me, and I'm going to make some black sleeves, and I'm going to take them over to ACD. I'm gonna call these guys who did these sleeves for me. I'm going to take the I'm just going to make plain black sleeves, and I'm going to take them over to ACD because I I'm friends with Maher, and he's running the company over there. I was like, they'll sell them, and I'm sure I can get him to just throw them on a shelf, and if somebody calls up and said, hey, you're out of Ultipro or you're out of Max, here are these. I don't know much about them, but here's a set of black sleeves you can get. That was my original thought. It's like, I might as well make a couple of colors. So I made a handful of colors. And then while I was at it, it's like, well, I might as well make a couple of art sleeves too. So I made a run that had the RTFC ones on it.
Okay.
And then Bacon. Those are my first two art sleeves. Because we did the RTFC, and we're sitting around in a meeting going, hey, so, like all my friends, like my store manager, it's like, so, and I actually wasn't at the discussion that happened when they came up with the Bacon idea, but I heard it and was like, yes, this is brilliant. The store manager,
we will make a sleeve of Bacon.
Well, what it was, all right, what do people like? What should we put on sleeves? And somebody says, I kid you not, everybody likes Bacon. And scene. We make Bacon sleeves. We sell thousands upon thousands upon thousands of units of them. It changed it up. It took it up. I don't want to, you know, I know my promo sleeve for that GP had, you know, typical fantasy stuff on it, but I'm not just a fantasy guy. I like fantasy art. That's not the only thing I do. I also like football. I also like to cook. I also like to build things. You know, I like music. I like cars. You know, there are things that I like. Pop culture. There's a rich, giant environment of pop culture. Like, it's all over the place. You know, pop culture is such a huge phenomenon right now that everybody is just like, all the fun little things, all the memes that happen, you know, that just take off and go crazy because of whatever reason, you know, keep calm and do whatever it is that somebody wants to put at the bottom of that line.
Yeah.
You know, all those things that are just happening. So, like, there's this wealth of stuff that's not dragons and chicks and chainmail. Let's do some of that. And that's that was our focus very specifically early on. And then the Bacon was just like, yes, you're doing it right. Well, like the success of that said, yes, you're doing it right. So we make them, we go on. And now finally some other folks are catching up with us. There are some Grumpy Cat sleeves coming.
Yeah, I heard you got you.
We did not do the Grumpy Cat sleeves.
Oh, well, yeah.
We did the kittens, wild and free ones.
Yes,
those are me. and that was crazy. We released those earlier this year, and I printed enough that I thought it would last 6 months, and it lasted 3 weeks.
And what's that like, being a trendsetter?
I don't know. As somebody who's a trendsetter. Oh,
okay. If you felt kind of awfully proud that companies are following your footsteps?
I have, and I'm happy to have opened up their eyes to show them that their customers are more than they're giving them credit for. That's certainly been a really neat thing to see. I'm still in the same boat I was with retail stores. I'm still in the same boat I was with events. I still think a rising tide lifts all boats.
Uh-huh.
And I'm happy to be a part of this. I'm excited that other companies, maybe Ultipro is making Grumpy Cat sleeves. I think you should buy them. If you like Ultipro sleeves, I think you should go buy them because it's cool.
Uh-huh.
And I think we should support the things we like, regardless of who's doing them, right? So that's just the way I am. I'm this weird cross of a hippie capitalist. You know? And I think that's neat that this is happening. You know, go buy the Max Bruce Lee sleeves because they're cool.
Uh-huh.
You know, if you don't like Max, don't buy them. If you don't like Ultipro, don't go buy them. But, like, if you have no disposition, absolutely you should buy them. If you think that picture is awesome, go get them. There are going to be so many of these things coming. because we did stick our foot in that door, and we did show the world that Magic players are more than just dragons.
Yeah.
And great. And I think that's a great step. And I think that does nothing but make everybody bigger.
Yeah.
That moves this into even more socially relevant, socially acceptable place. When we're not just hiding in corners and you know, wearing our capes and holding our swords going, man, I'm going to go to the Ren Fair this weekend. It's going to be totally sweet.
That's cool. That would be totally sweet.
It is totally sweet. I have a full set of chainmail. I don't know about you.
I don't. I have a chainmail dice bag. That's the only.
I made a suit of chainmail in my 20s.
You made one.
I went out and bought the wire. I wrapped it on a nail. I split it. I cut it. I weaved it. It took me a couple of months. I did it all by myself. And
wow.
Yeah, I think these are. So that's me. I'm not. When I say these, I'm not making fun of people to do Ren Fair things. I have four boxes full of carb in my basement. Uh-huh. I could be anything from a monk to a barbarian in 2 seconds flat because I enjoyed it. I haven't done much of that lately. Will I do it again? Maybe. So I sort of had that cosplay end of me in there as uh-huh. well, you know. So all of that is great and all of that is good, but it does freak some people out. As you said before, your initial reaction to cosplay was, well, I don't know, until you get the exposure.
Yeah.
So you got the gateway drug, again, I keep using that thing, of Gen Con where you come in and now you get exposure to those people and you find out, wow, they're just people.
Yeah.
All of this that we're doing and broadening into the pop culture and making all of the things that we're doing a little more accessible and a little more relevant to the rest of the world can do nothing except make more gamers.
Absolutely.
And how can that possibly be a bad thing?
And I have to say that's part of the goal of my podcast as well, sort of a side goal. I'm trying to make it very accessible. So all of you listeners out there that are listening that don't play Magic or are just into culture, I'd love to hear from you guys. So
there you go. Get them in. I got to go pretty quick. So
definitely.
Anything else we got to wrap up? And,
no, that's it. Thank you very much, Steve. Right. Where can they find your store and your events?
My store is in Burnsville, Minnesota. The website is legiongames.com.
Okay.
The event side, so for Grand Prix and 5K tournaments, that's legionevents.com. And then my supplies, the sleeves, deck boxes, things like that, is legionsupplies.com. Sense of theme. You can also go to legionbrands.com, and there's a link to any one of those. And then me, I work nonstop, and I'm around all the time, and my wife tells me to put my tablet down on a regular basis, but I'm always around. You got a question? Steve@anyofmycompanies.com. That's me.
Okay. Cool. Well, thank you very much, Steve.
All right. You bet. Thanks for the time.
You bet.